Good morning, Santa Fe. Welcome to Wake Up Call, your source in the morning for the world of Northern New Mexico at KSFR 101.1 FM. I'm Tom Trowbridge on this Monday, March 11th, 2019. It was on this date in 1985, Mikhail Gorbachev was chosen to succeed the late Konstantin Chernenko as General Secretary of the Soviet Communist Party. At the Roundhouse today, as the 2019 legislative session has less than a week to wrap up its business, it's the State Department of Veterans Services, Military and Veterans Day in the Capitol all day long. Ahead on Wake Up Call, MK will discuss the ridiculously high price of the life-saving hormone insulin for diabetics. Steve Terrell and I discuss recent Roundhouse happenings, and John Shannon has a local news update. But first, I'm with Kerry Jones, meteorologist in charge of the Albuquerque National Weather Service office. Kerry, we just wrapped up a meteorological winter, the months of December, January, and February. And what were the highlights and the extremes that we saw this three-month period?
Well, I think in a sentence, Tom, it could be summed up as what a difference a year makes. And, of course, I'm referencing the dismal winter that we had 12 months ago. That would have been the winter of 2017-18. So the winter months that just ended, as you mentioned, was pretty good for most of New Mexico. In fact, I would say a good part of the state. You know, if we kind of maybe zero in on Santa Fe as an example, and if we go back 20 years, I had just pulled up some records. I was kind of curious myself. And both Santa Fe and Albuquerque had their seventh wettest winter, again, in that 20-year stretch. So it wasn't, you know, we've obviously had some wetter periods here in the recent past, but it was good and certainly much better than what we had, as I said, 12 months ago. In fact, in Albuquerque specifically, we had nearly three times the precipitation from December 1st through the end of February that just ended than a year ago. And so obviously that translated into some pretty bountiful snowfall up in the northern mountains of New Mexico. In fact, most areas as we speak today are anywhere from about 98 to 120% of average for those basins. And so when you compare that to, again, last year, those numbers were in the 12 to 30% range. So significantly different from what we had a year ago. And, of course, now we're looking ahead to spring. And I'm often reminded by many folks that March can also, and April for that matter, can be still quite snowy for parts of northern New Mexico.
And Kerry, what role did or did not El Nino play in this bountiful snow winter we just had?
Well, and it took a while to, you know, officially declare the weak El Nino, which it was officially declared about a month ago. And so that's played an important, very important role. You know, as we know in New Mexico during the cool season, to include fall and winter, that even weak El Niños tilt the odds in favor of the state having above average precipitation. And, you know, as you look at statewide, as you look at the numbers, we came in right about average, maybe slightly above. And again, we're looking at roughly 124-year record statewide. So the precip and the weak El Niño certainly played a role. You know, when we look at temperatures, I didn't really say much about temperatures earlier, but when you look at the last, you know, 25 months, which is what I track kind of on a monthly basis, we've only had 4 months in the last 25 months that have been at or even below average temperature-wise. Now, two of those months happen to be the month of October and the month of November of this past fall.
2018.
So actually, December and January, statewide, temperature-wise, were above average on temperatures, despite the fact that we had a lot of good snow. And again, it's just a reminder that even in kind of a warmer climate scenario with above average temperatures, even in the wintertime, it doesn't necessarily mean we're not going to get snow. But definitely the weak El Nino, which is currently in place as we speak, played an important role.
Now, Kerry, oftentimes El Nino weather patterns are quickly followed by La Nina weather patterns, the opposite extreme. What does the future look for the coming 3 months in meteorological spring?
So the good news, and you know, we saw this even back into the fall of 2018, that the weak El Nino conditions that are in place now look to extend into spring and perhaps even into kind of the May-June timeframe. Kind of beyond that, so then we're kind of talking about next winter. There's really no strong indication that we'd be seeing a La Nina pattern like what we had in 2011 and 2012. So some good news on that front. In fact, when you look at the outlooks right on through springtime, the odds are still tilted in our favor for above average precipitation. So that would put us through May. And in fact, some of the models that we look at that kind of go out into that time range suggest that April and May precipitation could definitely be above average, especially the eastern half of New Mexico during the month of May, especially. So we're not done. We're not done with snow quite yet, and we're certainly looking at a pretty active pattern here for the next 6 to 10 days. And so everything is pointing in a favorable direction for the springtime.
Where does this leave us in terms of the statewide drought picture?
So that's always, an important discussion that we have actually every week. The one area of the state where we still have severe to extreme drought is up in the Four Corners area. Now, that said, even that area has seen improvement over the last 6 months. And in fact, all areas of New Mexico have seen marked improvement over the last 6 months. But it's that north central to northwest Four Corners area that still is kind of reeling from that dismal winter that we had a year ago. And so when we talk about drought, you know, a good wet winter is not going to pull us out of that extreme drought. It's going to take a little bit more than just that. So while we have seen the improvement and the trend as we get into spring is for the drought to remain but improve in those parts of the state, that's kind of the outlook that we're looking at as we get towards, you know, the warmer part of our year, which is upcoming. So we hope that if we have a good spring, which we think we will, and then we get into the monsoon season. So if we talk in about 8 or 9 months, hopefully we'll start to see that improvement continue with that drought becoming less and less coverage, certainly. But for most of eastern, a good chunk of central and southern New Mexico, the drought has pretty much been eliminated from the map.
Well, that's positive news, Kerry. And meteorologically for spring, you think it's going to be a relatively moist spring?
So, yes. I mean, the outlook definitely is hedging towards an above-average signal for precipitation. And that's especially up in kind of the Four Corners area. And then, as I said, as we get into April and May, it really starts to shift and look like eastern New Mexico, especially that northeast quarter, would be one of the more favored locations. You know, it's not unusual. Of course, once we get into the months of April and May, that's getting into our severe weather season on the eastern plains of New Mexico. So we'll see how that plays out. Of course, we want the precipitation, but we could do without the large hail and damaging winds and, of course, our threat of tornadoes in far eastern New Mexico. But that's sort of the outlook broadly for the months coming up, you know, March, April, and May combined. But especially that April-May timeframe, we'll be watching closely to see how this active storm track that we've been in definitely, as I said, looks to continue here for at least the next couple weeks. And so, you know, one or two big storms between now and early April can really make a huge difference. And the other point to make with that, Tom, is the temperatures look to, there's no strong signal, I should say, with above average, you know, temperatures. I mentioned my graph that I look at for the last 25 months, and there's only been four of those 25 months at or below average. So The outlook, as it turns out, is for near average temperatures. And that's a good solid forecast because you're pretty much bucking the trend, you know, that we've seen for the last couple years and beyond. And so if we don't have any major warm up here in the next foreseeable future, then of course, you know, we're going to hold the snow and have kind of a more typical snowmelt runoff season, you know, as opposed to some massive, you know, warm up and we melt all the snow and we create other issues aside from just the, you know, the warmth. So
sounds like we'll be incrementally shifting into springtime in New Mexico.
It is, yeah, and I mean it's very changeable. These kind of what I describe as shoulder seasons, you know, October, March time frames, we can just get very dynamic weather. And as we warm up, you know, we've been in the 70s now for Albuquerque, and I think it was in the mid-80s in the southeastern part of the state yesterday. You know, you start adding warmth to the air, and that starts to fuel the bigger storms, the thunderstorms in particular. So now we're talking about lightning, you know, and so when you go through kind of warm, dry stretches, then we're concerned, obviously, wildfire and so forth. But I guess the other good point to bring up is that the outlook for significant wildfire activity in the state is highest in the eastern part of New Mexico. That's the grasslands, the rangeland, during the month of April. But then for May and June, which kind of gets into the heart of our fire season for the forested areas of the state, the outlook is, you know, favorable, meaning that there's no, it's not above average like it was last year. And so not to say we won't have fires, of course, but the pattern has certainly been in our favor to mitigate a major threat.
Kerry, what can you tell us about New Mexico's current mountain snowpack situation, or can you?
Yeah, so as of this morning, the basins of northern New Mexico range from about 98% to 120% of normal. So basically you're looking at or just a little bit above average. As you get up into Colorado, the numbers are even better. And so, of course, the upper, the Rio Grande with its headwaters in southern Colorado, you know, those basins are up closer to about 130% or 150% of normal. So the snowpack is in good shape. It's been in good shape. I mean, we're still building snowpack, which once you get to about the middle part of April, you kind of start to lose more high elevation snow than you gain just because of the warming temperatures, higher sun angle, and so forth. So if we can keep the temperatures on the cooler side, which, you know, we've done for the most part, that trend should continue.
And, Kerry, anything else you think my listeners should know about the past meteorological winter and looking forward to the current and the end of meteorological spring?
Well, I would encourage any of your listeners, if they want some more specific data or, you know, information, you can visit our website, which is weather.gov, and you can go right in, click on New Mexico, and we have kind of a more detailed outlook for the springtime period that includes a lot more discussion on the weak El Nino and some other factors, I should say, that we look at. And so that might be of interest. And that's right in our headline section on our website.
Kerry Jones is meteorologist in charge at the Albuquerque National Weather Service office. Kerry, thanks for your time today.
Thanks as always, Tom.
And this is KSFR's Wake Up Call, 22 and a half minutes now after 8 o'clock. You know, most Mondays I check in with Steve Terrell and we discuss political developments in New Mexico and activities at the state capitol. Here's this week's edition. And I'm with Steve Terrell, the reporter and columnist with the Santa Fe New Mexican. And Steve, last week we saw bills on energy, guns and drugs. Let's start off with energy, and there was a pretty progressive bill approved in the state Senate. Tell us about that.
It's backed by a coalition of strange bedfellows. You got PNM. They're going to be bailed out of the debt they've invested in the bonds they've made for the San Juan Generating Station up near Farmington, which they want to close by 2022. the opposition, coalition includes like environmentalist groups like Sierra Club and conservation voters, Western Resource Advocates, as well as like various chambers of commerce in Santa Fe and Albuquerque and various unions. So you got the unions and the business groups on the one, on the same side, and then environmentalists and PNM on one side. The opposition, well, there's one major environmentalist group against it. That's the New Energy Economy, Santa Fe based, and they say it's too much of a giveaway to PNM. And then you have the city of Farmington, basically anyone involved in local governments there and their state legislative delegation, you're dead set against it because that power plant's a big source of employment for the Four Corners area. And so Bill Scherer from Farmington, a Republican from Farmington, he led the charge against it. He led a filibuster that lasted nearly 4 hours, at least 3.5 hours the other night. And it finally passed by a pretty big margin. In fact, a slight majority of Republicans in the Senate voted for it. An overwhelming number of Democrats did. So it's passed, it's gone to the House. I don't know if there'll be any more four-hour filibusters over there, but I'm sure Rod Montoya, who's a representative from Farmington, the Republican whip, will be leading the charge there against it. I think it'll probably pass, probably have an easier time in the House than in the Senate. And it's one to keep watching.
Well, filibusters are rare, of course, and kind of reminds me of that old movie, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. It might be, in this case, Mr. Scherer Goes to Santa Fe. That was a long, long, long filibuster. How did that all play out? You, unfortunately, I guess for your sake, you were witnessing it all, taking it all in at the same time.
Yeah. Oh, God, the filibusters. You know, the thing is about filibusters, it always made me wonder. I don't think they persuade a single vote. There may have been a couple of Republicans who voted against it. One casualty of that filibuster was the Senate House basketball game. They'd actually started the game, and they had to go round up the senators who were playing. So they ended up just playing like the House divided into two teams, and there was a House divided. The Senate had to come back. You'd see all these guys coming in their red jerseys and shorts, and it was quite a spectacle. Greg Baca, who's a senator from Denham Boleyn, he was wearing this sweaty T-shirt, and he said, "Mr. President, permission not to wear ties and jackets." He eventually did wear a tie and jacket. It was a weird filibuster because in the middle of it, they considered a gun bill. They passed after a three-hour debate. We didn't get the vote on the energy bill till real late that night. By that point, I'd gone back to the office and watching on the webcasting. But it was a crazy thing.
Well, speaking of guns, Steve, that gun legislation in the Senate did get approved. That was the background checks bill, of course. It has raised the hackles of county sheriffs. We've heard their testimony throughout the legislative session on the unenforceability of such a law, but we have this movement of 20-some-odd sanctuary counties out of the 33 in New Mexico. Your read on that so far?
Yeah, I went out to Tucumcari a couple of weeks ago and interviewed the sheriff there in White County. He's a real nice guy. I think his county was the first to adopt the sanctuary county deal. And a lot of other counties they're basically identical. I think Taos is a little bit different because the sheriff there said he'd still enforce the law. Which, you know, our system of government says it's the courts and not local sheriffs decide which laws are constitutional. But yeah, it's quite a movement. The old rebel in me kind of likes seeing local government standing up to, you know, to Washington, D.C. or Santa Fe or whatever, even if I don't absolutely agree with them on the issue. But I like their spirit. But yeah, there's supposedly could be a recall of the bill. This is an obscure part of the Constitution. If you get enough petition signatures, you can get it on the ballot and have people vote on it. Thing is, since I've been looking at the Capitol here, there have been two efforts I know of. Both of them, they started out with like I told one of my fellow reporters, they come in like a lion and go out like a lamb. They just sizzle.
Just like the month of March.
Just like the month of March, yeah. Most of these efforts will be dead by May, I think. But back in 2003, legislature passed and the governor signed Human Rights Act, which basically says you can't discriminate in housing or employment against gay people just on the basis of being they're being gay. And we're going to recall this bill. And, the opponents said they didn't. And then back, wasn't it 2009 when they repealed the death penalty and Governor Richardson signed it? Darren White, who was sheriff of Bernalillo, I believe, at the time, he led an effort to repeal the repeal and actually collected several thousand dollars for this big effort they're going to do to repeal the death penalty. It fizzled, too. Robert Knott did the story on this new effort to guns. And he pointed the legislative council to that. There's been several attempts. But only, I think, three have gotten on the ballot, and only one actually passed to repeal the law. And that was some obscure tax bill back in the 1950s. I was but a child, and you weren't even born. So,
yeah, for the record, they're 1 for 12.
Steve Terrell is a reporter with and columnist with the Santa Fe New Mexican, and I appreciate him joining us on Mondays here on KSFR's Wake Up Call. It's coming up on 8:30. We go now to local news with John Shannon.
This is KSFR News. Good morning. I'm John Shannon. The New Mexico Supreme Court has turned away Republican legislators' lawsuit challenging Democratic Secretary of State Maggie Toulouse-Oliver's move to require more disclosure of contributors to so-called dark money organizations that spend on political campaigns. The New Mexican reports that all five justices concurred Friday in denial of the petition by State Senators Mark Moores of Albuquerque and Bill Scharer of Farmington, and State Representatives Jim Stickler of Farmington and David Gallegos of Eunice. The lawmakers contended that Toulouse-Oliver's implementation of a disclosure rule was an attempted end run around New Mexico's constitution. The new rule requires such groups to report the names and addresses of those contributing above certain thresholds. Legislation to require disclosures was vetoed by former Governor Susana Martinez, a Republican. Senator Clemente Sanchez's Senate Bill 437 takes an incremental approach to increasing New Mexico's minimum wage. The Democrat from Grants explains his bill this way.
What I'm doing here with this bill is that I'm stepping it up in order to give businesses, small businesses, restaurants, everyone a time to adjust to the new minimum wage. As you can see, it first steps up every 6 months, begin when we leave here, then in 6 months it will go to the $9.25, then to $10, and then it will be annually after that till it gets to $11.
Sanchez's bill is not indexed by inflation for future increases. It also establishes an $8.50 an hour student wage and boosts the rate for tipped employees by a quarter an hour to $2.38. The measure passed on a 27-15 vote Saturday. GOP Senate leader Stuart Ingle of Portales was among those voting nay.
Every time we raise wages in government, it doesn't matter where they start, because the wages are going to have to go up. And if the employer can't do it, it just plain doesn't work.
The House has approved its own minimum wage increase that tops out at $12 an hour, but with automated future increases tied to inflation. Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham has signed a bill that will expand mandatory background checks on firearm sales to include transactions between private individuals. The bill was signed into law Friday after weeks of divisive debate over the constitutional rights of gun owners, school safety, and gun violence. The Brady Center, a Washington-based nonprofit that advocates for expanding gun control, says more than 20 states have similar laws calling for at least some restrictions on private firearm sales. Sheriffs across the state had been among the legislation's most vocal opponents as they declared they would not enforce the measure or other bills still being debated by lawmakers. Now for the regional weather outlook. Scattered showers and thunderstorms will develop northward over New Mexico today and tonight. A few of those storms in the Rio Grande Valley and parts of eastern New Mexico may become strong with small hail and strong winds. Heavy wet snow will also fall with this system today and tonight above 9,500 feet where 6 to 12 inches are likely. Santa Fe weather, showers and possibly a thunderstorm today through Tuesday, the high today 52, tonight's low 38, Tuesday's high 53. There's a 90% chance of precipitation through the forecast period. For KSFR News, I'm John Shannon.
And this is KSFR's Wake Up Call. 26 minutes now in front of 9 o'clock. I'm Tom Trowbridge. Thanks for tuning in this morning. Well, the American Diabetes Association estimates there are 1.25 million Americans who have type 1 diabetes, the more less prevalent but more serious type of the condition where the body fails to make insulin, which is needed to deliver sugar to cells. But the rising price of insulin now equals about $1,500 a month for some, for out-of-pocket or for the uninsured, and insurance companies randomly change which insulins they cover, all of which makes insulin one of the most expensive fluids in the world. MK now speaks with leading expert of diabetes, Dr. Daniel Ofri.
Good morning and welcome to this segment of Your Morning Wake-Up Call. I'm your host, MK. Today, we talk diabetes. Not just about the costs in health, but also the cost to the pocketbook and in lives. Joining us today is Dr. Danielle Ofri. She is a physician at the Bellevue Hospital, the oldest public hospital in the country, and a faculty member of NYU School of Medicine. She writes about medicine and the doctor-patient connection for the New York Times, Slate Magazine, and other publications. She's also co-founder and editor-in-chief of the Bellevue Literary Review, the first literary journal to arise from a medical setting, and she's the author of a collection of books about the world of medicine. Welcome, Danielle Ofri. It's a pleasure to have you on our show and an honor for you to take the time out of your busy schedule today.
Thank you, MK. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I saw your piece in the New York Times. It was an opinion piece about the insulin wars. And I wonder if you can begin to tell us about that problem and how we got there.
So I'll even backtrack on how I even came to write the piece. I'm a regular primary care doctor. I'm an internist. And a lot of my patients have diabetes, and I was having, on that day, a particularly difficult time getting my patient's insulin prescription to go through. I would write the brand that she was taking, and then she would call and say, it's not covered, and I would try again, make the change that I saw, and then that's not covered, and then a third one, and I just could not get this prescription to go through. And then when I finally called the pharmacist and worked on it, the one that was covered wasn't even top tier. There was no top tier. So the price was, even with the copay, was almost $100 a month, which was more than she could afford. So I began to write this piece just in my frustration of writing an insulin prescription. But what I uncovered in researching it was the incredible increase in cost of insulin. Over the years, since about 2003, it has nearly tripled in price, much more than in the cost of living or inflation, to a point that many patients can no longer afford it.
And can we talk about what that cost looks like, what it used to be to what it is now?
I mean, it used to be that insulin could be $20, $50 a vial. Now it can be $300 a vial, and sometimes more, $500 for some of the newer brand names, at a pace that is unsustainable for so many patients.
And a patient can use several vials, correct? Go through several in a month. What's the average amount that, say, a patient would go through within a month?
It really varies. Some patients use one vial a month. Some patients can use 4 or 5 vials a month, depending on the needs for their diabetes.
And your article, you cited a cost of $300 a vial, and if you figure 300 times 5, that's $1,500 per month just to get your insulin.
And that's every month. And it's not a medication you can come and go on. You either are taking insulin or you're not. It's not like Motrin or Tylenol or antibiotic. You just need it one point. It's a forever, and for most patients, a lifetime medication.
Let's clarify that, because I think there are some people who have diabetes or get diagnosed with type 2, and some will even go without taking their meds. They don't fully understand the seriousness of what diabetes can look like. But there's also something like type 1 diabetes, and I know about this because my mother suffered from type 1, and it's a very, very different disease, and it can cause all sorts of different symptoms. And would you like to help educate the listeners on the difference between type 1 and type 2 and how they differ from each other?
For type 1 diabetes, it's an autoimmune disease where the cells in the pancreas that make the insulin are slowly destroyed. And at some point, usually at a young age, the pancreas makes no insulin at all. And a person with type 1 diabetes has no insulin, therefore requires all the time injectable insulin to do the job and will not survive without it. Person with type 2 diabetes may have insulin, but insulin doesn't work well. It's like insulin is the key in the door to let the glucose, the sugar, go into the cell. And that key isn't working well. And it can work because there's not enough around, or the door, you know, the key's got gunk in it, it's jammed up, and they don't have enough insulin working well enough. And so if people with type 2 diabetes can often in the beginning manage on just pills or even on diet if it's mild. But type 2 diabetes runs a gamut from mild to severe, and at the severe end can end up looking a lot like type 1 diabetes in terms of the complications and the severe effects on health and the reliance on insulin.
What are the kind of things that can happen to somebody if they go without insulin?
For type 1 diabetes, if they go without insulin, they can very quickly, their body can be overwhelmed. And the worst case scenario is a situation called DKA, or diabetic ketoacidosis. And that is a medical emergency. Someone ends up in the hospital in the intensive care unit because without insulin, their sugar shoots up to such a high degree, they can become unconscious, their blood pressure can bottom out, they can have a seizure, they can die. So it's quite life-threatening. Most type 2s won't reach that level, although some can get quite sick enough to be in the ICU as well. And even if you can have a form of DKA that is quite similar, usually the onset is slower, but they can be equally sick and in the hospital, dehydrated, and requiring serious interventions. If the sugar is not well controlled in the long run over years, people have very devastating effects of the blood vessels, and that goes to anywhere. So people can have heart attacks and strokes. They can have blindness. They can have amputations. They can end up in a wheelchair. The gut cannot work well. All the places of the nerves innervate in the body can be affected by that. So in the old days, before we had effective treatments, it was very common to see people in wheelchairs with amputations, blind, and who also are on dialysis because of the kidney failure from the poorly treated diabetes.
Something also that comes into play with diabetes that I've known several diabetics in my life, and something that people don't often understand is there's also mood dysregulation that can happen sometimes with diabetes, correct? Can you talk a little bit about that just to inform people?
Sure. I mean, diabetes is an endocrine system, so it affects many of the hormones in the body, adrenaline, and many pituitary hypothalamic hormones. So it certainly makes sense that if your body begins to dysregulate from the insulin, it can have many mood effects, anxiety, depression. When people become, without their medication, very sick, they can almost look psychotic at times, even though they don't have a baseline psychosis, but their mental orientation can be affected gravely.
Yeah, right. And in fact, I know there were a number of times where my mother had car accidents, and when she was pulled over, the cops thought she was drunk because she both emitted an odor that smells like alcohol, but also the behavior is such that they can appear drunk.
Yeah, and when the blood sugar fluctuates and drops very low, hypoglycemia, people can become dizzy and woozy or pass out, and that can certainly lead to car accidents and other devastating consequences.
Yeah. Let's talk about then what happens when they can't get their insulin. Some people apparently are now rationing their insulin, even though they're insulin dependent. And what happens when that goes on?
I just say, as a physician, when I hear about that, it breaks my heart. Like, there's some things in life that shouldn't be rationed, and insulin is one of them. Any of your important medications, it's heartbreaking in a society that has this available that one should have to be rationing. So when you cut back on your insulin, remember, insulin is the key that opens the lock, opens the door to let the glucose in your blood go safely into the cells of the muscle and the liver and the fat where it gets stored. So that doesn't happen, or doesn't happen as much as it should. So now the blood sugar levels in the bloodstream stay elevated. And that has many consequences, including dehydration. People can get unconscious. They are more prone to infections. They can't see so well because it affects the vision. And people can, over time, get sicker and sicker. And there have been a number of reported deaths of patients who have been rationing insulin and may have been home alone with no one to keep an eye on them. And if you begin to lose consciousness and there's no one there, you will dehydrate and quickly die.
It is a life and death issue, especially when it comes to type 1. My mother wouldn't survive without the insulin. She would just die, period.
Type 1 diabetics have no room for error on insulin, and many type 2s have very little room for error.
And yet these people, because they don't have the money or their insurance is not covering it, they're finding themselves in situations where I was reading in an article where they actually even purposefully kind of go low, let themselves go low so they can get into the emergency room so that they can actually get some free samples of insulin. And of course, as you say, rationing, they just go without.
Yes, yes. And what was interesting for me is, you know, I've written a lot of pieces over the years, but this article garnered more response and letters and comments than anything I've written in my entire life. I didn't realize what a nerve this was. I really thought I was writing about my own difficult experience as a doctor trying to get this stupid prescription to go through. But in fact, it's an enormous problem. And amongst the letters I got of the really hundreds were so many from Europe writing, say, oh, you know, in Switzerland, insulin is free. In Belgium, I get it, you know, with a dollar copay from all the countries with, you know, universal health care, for which insulin is just an obvious no-brainer. It's available to anyone, and cost is not the issue, because the cost of untreated diabetes so swamps the cost of insulin that one would think, if you're thinking rationally, it makes sense to have insulin to be free or very low cost.
So how and why have the prices gone up so high? What's causing this?
That is a complicated question, as I learned as I began to dig into this. The first thing I learned is that the inventors, let's say the people who discovered insulin, they purified it from animal sources. But they held a patent, which, as you can imagine, would be an incredibly valuable patent. They sold the patent for $1 each.
Wow.
Because they said insulin should be available to everyone. And I believe it was Banting or Best who said, as a physician, I cannot in good conscience earn money off this discovery that is so valuable to my patients. So the fact that we are where we are, given where it started from, is all the more horrifying. But yes, let's go into what happens. So one thing to know is that insulin, now we no longer purify from animal sources. We create it in the lab, grow it in cells. So it's more purified, it's the better form than the original. But it's not an easy medicine to make. You know, I will grant it's not a chemistry type experiment like sodium chloride. It's a biological compound. And so it needs to be, it is more expensive to make. There's no doubt about it. Is it that much more expensive? I don't think so. But it is a little more expensive to make than other medications. But what the real issue comes in is the patent protection that the pharmaceutical companies get for a certain number of years in order to cover the cost of research and development. And I think it's fair. You know, drug companies should earn money for the work they've done. But what happens is instead of letting the patent run out, now we have generics, they'll make a small tweak, a tiny modification that extends the patent. And there has been some suggestion that many of the drug companies have actually pressed generic companies not to make generics, to kind of force them out with a little bit of dirty dealing, for which there is currently a lawsuit in play, to prevent generics because it's such a moneymaker. So there's the aspect of prolonging the patent by making small tweaks that aren't really changing things. That's issue one. But the second issue I learned about is that between the drug companies and then the insurers or your employer's insurance company that decide what to cover, there's a middleman, and they're called pharmacy benefit managers, PBMs. And big companies like CVS, Caremark, you hear about them, and Express Scripts, these are pharmacy benefit managers who, for insurance companies, kind of manage the whole medication formulary. And so they are busy trying to strike deals with the drug companies. And what will often will happen is the drug company will then raise the price so they can give a, quote, discount to the PBM to try and get them to carry it. So the prices get inflated, but the pharmacy benefit managers are making a huge profit in the middle, but they're not really adding, they're not creating the medication or giving it. They're just sort of being a middleman. So this middle thing, and it's very opaque because we don't know what are the deals, how it's happening, but somehow between the drug company and the pharmacy benefit managers, insurance companies, in the dark, there's some kind of deals for which a lot of money is being made and the savings are not being passed on to the patients.
Right. And they're rebates, I guess, sort of built-in rebates, right?
Rebates are all of these rebates and drug company coupons, you know, there's never a free lunch, and we all know that. So whenever there's a freebie or a rebate, there's a string attached to that. So you get a free, you know, dosing medication for 1 month or a discount for 2 months, but you need it for 50 years. So that little bit of rebate or freebie ultimately isn't going to matter much, but then you might get caught, and then that's now the one you get, that's much higher priced one, if, you know, lower cost alternatives available. unfortunately, with insulin, there isn't that much. The only thing there is an older form of insulin called NPH. It's actually available without a prescription. I'm not really sure how or why. At Walmart, people have told me. And it's, you know, it's certainly an alternative. It doesn't work quite as well for many patients, but that is an alternative.
And tell us the name of that again.
NPH. And it's a much, much older form of insulin that doesn't last as long as the newer 24-hour insulins. And for many patients, it's harder to take. But it is available, people have told me, without a prescription at Walmart. Of course, you shouldn't be dosing it without being in conversation with your doctor or your nurse, because the dosing of insulin is very finely tuned, and too much or too little can also be devastating.
And how does this new pricing actually put the onus on doctors and their patients?
Well, what happens is, you know, I'll write a prescription for my patient's Lantus. That's the medication they've been taking for 10 years. And they go to the pharmacy and say, oh, it's not covered. Then the patient is upset and concerned. They have to call me and get through my secretary to me. Then I have to figure out which one is covered. And that's not easy to do. I mean, do I go? I tried yesterday, in fact, to go on the Emblem Health's website and try and figure out which one. I couldn't figure it out. So I just try another one. That doesn't work. And you know, it can be hours of phone calls and faxing back and forth and real time that's just wasted, time that really should be for doctors to be with patients or do something, you know, of value. This is just like busy work and paperwork. And I feel like the insurance companies, you know, it doesn't bother them. It's not sweat off their back. They can just sort of offload the work of dealing with this to the doctors, but also offload the pain. Like, who ends up telling the patient that your medication is covered? It's usually the pharmacist or the doctor has to break the bad news, and or they'll say, oh, your doctor, you know, wrote the wrong prescription. They did the wrong thing, and kind of add a little negativity, you know, between the doctor and patient in their relationship that really isn't relevant to anything. So it adds a ton of busy work for not a lot of gain.
And so what needs to happen to prevent this kind of drug pricing?
Well, one thing is we need a Sunshine Act. We need to know what is going on between the drug companies, the pharmaceutical benefit, the PBM, the pharmacy benefit managers, and the insurance companies. What are all the deals? We should know about that. I mean, after all, the drug companies may say that, well, they do all this research and development, but most of the basic science comes from NIH-funded research, public money that funds universities to do basic science research and a lot of drug research. And so although drug companies do put in effort and money, a lot of the basic science is publicly funded. And so I feel as though we as the public, we are owed a little bit more clarity in what's going on. We have a stake in that. The drug companies didn't get there by themselves. They got there on the backs of the scientific community, which is, a community asset. So the first thing is, what is going on with the deals? And the second is, I think that we need some kind of legislation. There's no reason that medications have to be that expensive, especially when the same companies, when they market to Europe, the prices are lower because, you know, they will buy it then, you know, in other countries. So American patients are charged much more than their international counterparts. And the third, I think, and that's a much bigger societal question, is how we view healthcare. You know, is healthcare a commodity that you buy and sell, like, you know, nice phones and nice cars? Or is it a community benefit, like, you know, fire protection, right? Anyone can call the fire department or the police department for an emergency. You don't have to, you know, pay a fee every month or per fire that you call someone for. We all fund it with our taxes. And so this is my personal feeling, is that healthcare is a similar thing. It should be a right for everyone. We should make a decision that, you know, healthcare is a community benefit. We all get it. And that therefore, there should be some controls on prices, that we can't make it, you know, a commercial venture like we do for luxury cars.
Yeah, it certainly feeds the argument of Medicaid for all. Seems to feed this. If there's any argument that would help make that case, this one seems to be a strong one. Would you?
Yeah, I think.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I certainly agree. And partly is the pharmaceutical companies. They have a lot of lobbyists in Washington. So, for example, Medicare and Medicaid can't negotiate for drug prices. You know, and you would think they should be able to. They have such a big market. They, you know, do a lot of medications for so many people. They'd have a lot of bargaining power, but they're prohibited by law. And why would that be? That would be because drug company lobbyists have, you know, pressured Congress, you know, to disallow that. So there's a lot of money at stake, and I think the follow the money is always a good, you know, a good dictum, because that's where the action is. And insulin should not be a way to line people's pockets at the expense of, you know, people dying from it. There was a young man, a college student, who died, and his mother has become quite the activist. And can you imagine the pain of a parent to see your child die from a medication that, you know, because he'd aged out of her health insurance plan and couldn't afford it? I can't even imagine the pain. And there's no reason in America in the 21st century, we're the richest country in the world, and we have, you know, our citizens can't afford their insulin.
Yeah, and there are also lawsuits in action. Do you want to talk about any of those?
Two, I don't know a lot of the details, but I believe several state attorneys general, and I believe Wisconsin is the site of the main lawsuit, are suing to find out what are the contractual negotiations between the drug companies and these PBMs to see why the price has gone up so extensively. And in fact, a few of the drug company companies have been called to Congress to testify. So it's beginning to shed light on the issue. And I think as lawmakers hear from their constituents that, you know, the medications are really unaffordable, and insulin in particular, but by no means only insulin, that it's going to come to light. And I see that in the next election cycle, that healthcare is really on people's minds. And I believe the Affordable Care Act, for whatever flaws it has, certainly brought the idea to the forefront of the community conversation that really everyone deserves healthcare, and we should be thinking how best to do it, not whether or not we should all get good healthcare.
Yeah, and I do know that New Mexico is also involved in conducting some of the investigations, according to Novo Nordisk, on the insulin pricing. So clearly, even calling our legislators, getting a hold of our congresspeople would probably be a good idea in this regard if anybody's struggling with their diabetes. And
I would certainly recommend that, because I know that legislators, their offices keep track of the number of calls and what they're about. So even if you don't think it is going to make a difference, just make the call and say, you know, my name is so-and-so, I live in your district, I'm on this medication, my child is, we can't afford it, what are you doing about it? And if they hear that, then they have to act, because, you know, they do need to represent their constituents, and this is an important issue, and it might be one of the defining issues of our times. I mean, as it is, the U.S., we come out last when it comes to health statistics compared to other developing countries. In fact, we fall behind, you know, many underdeveloped countries in maternal mortality and all kinds of things that seem ridiculous in this day and age. And, you know, another comparable thing is the asthma inhalers. I mean, those went back on patent, and now every asthma inhaler is about $80. And in Europe, they're over-the-counter. You can buy another prescription for the equivalent of $5 or $6. And again, asthma patients cannot be without their inhalers, and they can die and die very quickly. They have an asthma attack and don't have an inhaler, and yet it's a, you know, it's a cost and it's a profit issue.
How long can a diabetic go without insulin? How long would it be before they would die if they, say, a type 1 went without insulin? How long would it take?
It's an issue of a day or two, a few days at most, depending on, you know, how severe their diabetes is. But very quickly, if you have no baseline insulin in your body, within a day or so, you would be comatose. I mean, where I, you know, we see it a lot is if someone gets arrested and in prison doesn't have their insulin with them and doesn't have access to that right away, very quickly, within the day or so, they're becoming unconscious and usually end up being brought to the hospital. But, you know, what a terrible way to have to do that.
Yeah, it's a very, very scary disease. If people want to get a hold of you, how do they contact you?
Sure, my website is danielleofri.com. That's O-S-R-I. And I have a contact tab, and it goes right to me. And I also send out about a monthly newsletter with interesting articles that relate to medicine, doctor-patient relationship, doctor-patient communication. And I'd be happy to hear from anyone.
Danielle Ofri, thank you for joining us today and sharing your wisdom and knowledge again, and for writing this article and bringing attention to this very important issue.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
And that does it for Monday's Wake Up Call. Many thanks for tuning in. I'm Tom Tropridge. Have a great day.